Welcome, fellow seekers. My name is Nathan, and this is the Law of One and Spiritual Concepts podcast, where I share my interpretations of the Law of One and other related topics. Today, I'm excited to share an interview I did with a good friend of mine on NDEs and the Law of One. Today, I am honored to welcome Chris to the podcast here. Chris is a member of our local Law of One group that I've met a few years back, who has a wealth of knowledge. So I hope you all enjoy. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Nathan. It's great to be here.
Yeah, looking forward to the conversation. So today we're going to be talking about the Law of One and NDEs. So I guess if you don't mind starting, what is a little bit of your history and how you got into the Law of One and NDEs, just to give us all a little bit of background?
Sure, yeah, I'm happy to share. So I've been a spiritual seeker most of my life, with like a 20-25 year break for a stressful, demanding career. But, you know, I started my journey pretty young. My father was a minister, and I rejected organized religion at a pretty young age. And then in high school, I started reading, you know, the Bhagavad Gita and Native American, like Lakota cosmology and religion, Zen. I went on in college to major in Japanese and East Asian studies. I had a college level course in Zen Buddhism, which was pretty interesting. And I remember telling my college advisor at the time that my goals were to move to Japan after graduation and become enlightened, which I said with a straight face.
That's amazing.
And then after college, you know, I kind of had that fork in the road. And instead of going to Japan, I ended up back east with my first wife, who didn't want to have anything to do with Japan. And, you know, at that point, I felt like I had to kind of compromise my spiritual seeking in an effort to get a job and a career going. I felt like 10 years of esoteric pursuits had made me perhaps a little too passive or too much the observer, and that I needed to, you know, be more assertive, if not aggressive, to kind of get a job or a career off the line, you know, off the ground, I should say. And after exploring a couple different options, I ended up getting a full scholarship to law school, and I became a government lawyer for 20 years, which was not what I had envisioned for my life. And I was an insurance regulator. You know, I wasn't in private practice, but I was in public service. So I spent a lot of my time and effort helping consumers, going up against insurance companies, crooked insurance brokers and agents, things like that. But I'll tell you, after about 20 years of that, you know, I was super unhealthy. I had really, whatever spiritual aspirations I had in my youth had kind of been replaced by what I would call, like, you know, philosophical materialism bordering on hedonistic nihilism. And it was just not good. I was unhealthy. I was hypothyroid. I was overweight. I was drinking a lot. You know, whatever you could do to kind of get through all that.
Like, and job and society, basically.
Yeah, kind of forced. Yeah. And it's almost like, you know, the red ray survival in like an economic and a emotional sense. You know, it was very hard kind of trying to get a career off the ground. So anyway, in the end of 2015, my wife now had, you know, for want of a better word, a vision, where one Saturday we lived out in the woods and she was going out to feed the birds. We had a bunch of animals. And she was going out and she had like a vision that we needed to make a change, and that if we didn't do it now, it would be too late. And because she had seen me like slowly losing my elan vital, you know, when all you're doing is working and consuming, you know, that I think on a deep subconscious level, we kind of want it to be over, you know, the thanatos, that death instinct is strong, and you know, start losing, you know, losing your spark,
for want of a better word. What am I living for?
Yeah. And I had this moment where I'm like, I've spent the last 20 years pursuing things that really don't mean anything to me. This isn't what I wanted for my life. I was always, my goal was to try to figure things out, you know, whether it's the meaning of life, what we're doing here. I had always had a really strong desire for seeking. And I realized that, you know, I felt like I was praying to the wrong gods, metaphorically speaking, and that we needed a change. So we talked about it, and we both quit multi-decade careers the same morning, cleaned out our desks, and we left. We took a year off to kind of begin to decompress, to begin to unpack, to begin to heal. We sold our house. We did some traveling, sold our house, and then picked up and moved. And, you know, we ended up in Colorado, which has been great. It's, you know, yeah. As I like to say, the logos is strong here. The sun brings out the friendly in people. It's a really good place for kind of regrowth, I guess I would say. So, you know, this was the end of 2015. And after that, you know, my wife told me that I could be retired if I don't mind doing our shopping and cooking. And I was like, yes, please sign me up. And that gave me time to really rededicate myself to things that were meaningful to me. And I cast a very wide net in terms of spiritual searching, in terms of, you know, following up on any of those interesting artifacts of reality, paranormal, that I didn't have time to really pay attention to before. So over time, you know, I lost over 100 pounds. I lost any desire to drink. My life totally changed into something. We reinvented ourselves in a more meaningful, minimalist way that has just been wonderful. And I'm fortunate. My wife has kind of been on the path with me. It really helps to have a partner. But, you know, I found the law of one. So I cast a very wide net and I started exploring any avenue that sounded interesting to me, you know, some paranormal, some spiritual. I had a very good friend of mine that had been into paranormal phenomenon since the 90s. And when we were driving out to the Northwest, he casually mentioned like, oh, you know, keep an eye out for Bigfoot. You know, Bigfoot's real. And I kind of gave him the smirk and the side eye, like, what? You know, I'd always been skeptical. And, you know, I spent several months. I thought, well, before I write this off, I should actually look into it. I spent several months doing a deep dive into all the related phenomenon and, you know, evidence of Sasquatch. And at the end of that, I was like, oh my gosh, I, you know, eventually my skepticism, you know, that needle of skepticism, the more evidence you read, it slowly starts to shift. And, you know, Occam's razor, you know, the simplest answer being the most likely correct one, begins to shift. And I realized, oh my gosh, you know, it's actually much more likely that this is a legitimate thing. And then I was really struggling to make sense of it. Why is this suppressed? What is it? What is this thing? And why are we not encouraged to believe in this? And I also did a deep dive after that into the UFO phenomenon, which is another thing that's in the headlines recently with David Grush and some of the disclosure coming forward, which, you know, I think the two are related, you know, honestly.
It's all related.
Yeah. It is all related. Everything's related. but to be honest, I think I went through a period where I had such an intense desire for answers that I've come to believe that's what brought the Law of One to me, you know.
That seeking. Right?
Yes, that, yeah. Yes. So Kuo, who is another entity that's channeled by LNL Research, of which Ra is included, is a part, has said that, like, the power of our desire, the power of our seeking, acts as a vacuum in our future to draw to us that which we desire, that which we seek. And they're very... they caution us about being mindful of our desires and what we desire and what we direct that focus of the will. You know, that's really what desire is. It's kind of focusing of your will that does have an impact on your future. So I found the Law of One through initially Aaron Abke's podcast, which he does a nice job summarizing it. I don't agree with everything that he says there, but, you know, I feel like... today, I mean, there are a lot of people that found the Law of One, you know, that were spiritual seekers in the 90s or that had a friend give them a book. It seems like a lot of people find it now either through Aaron Abke or through David Wilcock. Yep. Which I know is how you found it initially, right?
Yep, that was my history. It was David introducing it, but Aaron does a great job, though. He does a lot of baseline information and gets in depth. So
and a good overview of what's really meaty, dense stuff. It's, you know, he summarizes it really, really well, and it ultimately is what got me to want to read the text material itself. So, you know, I agree that like the conspiracy vibration is not helpful in our long term spiritual growth, but I think it can provide an important kind of stepping stone or entree into higher spiritual principles.
Yeah.
You know, as Ra talks about, the, you know, part of the UFO phenomenon is to introduce people to limitless possibilities.
This, the mystery, like, right, the mystery of the creator.
Yes, yeah. The mystery of the creator. So I think that has a place in our seeking, but ultimately we need to set it aside. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Personally, because once you get into higher kind of information, you realize that lower vibrational things, you know, secret knowledge, occult information, keeps you vibrating a little bit in a lower state. And there's a lot of people in the Sasquatch world and the UFO world that dedicate their lives to it, but they don't make a ton of progress because I feel like they still have limiting beliefs. You know, at some point, these are phenomenon that are greater than our ability to fully comprehend them.
Yeah.
And so the way that you know, we need to slowly relax our belief systems, for want of a better word, to make room for things that are bigger than they can contain a little bit.
Hard to interject there. The law of one really does that. I feel like a lot of the people that we talk to frequently as well, the same thing. You get into the conspiracy side. Oh, UFOs brought me to the law of one. But once you crack open that book and start going to the deeper spiritual concepts in there, your focus seems to change. And that's, I don't know, that's why I think it's so beautiful when I hear that story over and over as well. It's exactly what you're describing.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, for me, I was looking, before I found the Law of One, I was really looking for what I would call a unified theory of the paranormal. I thought that these are all related phenomenon that are pointing to something bigger going on. And it wasn't until, you know, I found the Law of One that it really connected the dots from the macro to the micro in a way that allowed me to make sense of all the related phenomenon, whether it's ghosts, whether it's ETs, whether it's Sasquatch, things like that. So it was just tremendously helpful for me. And it's something that over time I introduced my wife to. She had heard me talk about it a bunch, and she ended up reading it a few times. And, you know, she will say it was the single most, you know, instrumental, revolutionary thing to help her make sense of the world as well. And, you know, it's been something that, you know, has really caused a paradigm shift in how we view things. You know, it helps to, you know, in terms of personal growth, to, you know, when you're trying to, like, unpack a lifetime of pain and, you know, heal the shadow, do those that shadow work, to really come to recognize that, you know, it was all done for us. Nothing was done to us. It's all done for us. And, you know, I think once you make that fundamental shift, you see, you know, you open the door to healing and you see everything, you know, with a lens of gratitude, to be honest. So, you know, as far as the Law of One, I ended up either reading it or listening to it at least a dozen times. And then I was intrigued enough by it, I decided to go back, as you know, and begin reading all of LNL Research's channeling archive. So I started at the beginning of when they stopped recording over their tapes, mm-hmm. you know, which I think was in the 70s. And I started reading progressively up into the present day. I'm in 2019, and it's just been tremendous. It's such a wealth of spiritual information, and you know, it's interesting to see how their focus changed and how the entities they channeled in the early days slowly changed over time, and then how the channelers changed, because it was largely Carla Rucker and Jim, and then they would train different people at different times, and even David Wilcock channeled with them. I believe it was in the aughts, but there were some periods in the channeling session where David was channeling David's guidance system in a, you know, pretty interesting way. And so I didn't realize that there was a pretty direct and intimate relationship there before he went on to Gaia and some of, you know, some of his other pursuits. But so anyway, that's kind of how I found the Law of One, and I've just found it super helpful. You know, as far as NDEs, that was just one of many things that I started exploring in an attempt to try to piece together, you know, a pointillist kind of mosaic, more data points of what's going on here a little bit. And it's an area that I keep coming back to because for a number of different reasons. I mean, you know, why do I think NDEs are important? Well, first of all, they are kind of direct, firsthand, anecdotal experiences that largely bolster everything Ross says about the nature of reality. You know, no two are identical, but there are recurring themes over and over and over again. Themes of love, themes of light, themes of unity, of healing, of, you know, the lifting of the veil, experiencing expanded consciousness, guides and light beings or deceased relatives that meet people. And so anyway, for me, it really, it dovetailed very well with the raw material because, you know, let's face it, the raw material is a little bit dense.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like an engineering manual. They were, had very narrow parameters on what they could weigh in on. And they picked very precise, exacting language. So you have this on the one hand, which is almost like a manual versus these people that actually crossed over and, you know, experienced a lifting of the veil and a incredibly expanded awareness of what was going on and then came back to share their experience.
In their own words, right? Their,
yes.
So like it's your own experience. It doesn't have to be the scientific mind. It's just how would you describe this extreme situation that happened to you? And that's much more relatable, it seems.
And you can hear, you know, you can see there, you can hear me. It was truly a life-changing experience for these people that, you know, it's one thing if we're able to learn from our own experiences, which, you know, takes us a while to do that. But if we can learn from others' experience, I think that's even better. And, you know, if you look at what Ross says about reality, you know, third density, you know, our everyday reality is not the density of knowing. We can't prove anything. We can't really know much. And it's only through, but we can experience it through expanded awareness. So it's one of those things. There are people that are able to do that. And, you know, it's a, it's kind of like an inside line into what it feels like to experience these things, you know? So anyway, it's very helpful for me in terms of bolstering my faith and my will to keep seeking, which is really why we enter third density, why we have the veil of forgetting, why we have a drastically narrowed, filtered, dim consciousness that we're trying to work through. And it's to build that faith muscle, build our will and faith, you know, from putting one foot in front of the other without knowing what, you know, and just, you know, having faith without knowing that it's going somewhere, that we're on a trajectory, that this is a vector that we're working through. So for me that, you know, it really was helpful in bolstering faith. And the other reason I think they're important is because we're all going to go there one day. This is, we are all going to cross that transom, that threshold into larger life. We are all going to have that veil of forgetting lifted. So I think the more we can learn from other people's experiences that went through that and came back, the less fear we're going to have and the smoother a transition we'll have when it comes.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, I know that's why the Buddhist practices kind of focus on that as well, is no longer fearing death and making that transition a little more seamless and less full of fear. But the other part with the NDEs that I think is interesting too, if you have more of the scientific mind, it seems like a lot of doctors are studying these things as well these days. So they'll put scientific empirical research back behind it to prove this person really what did transition over. They saw their body. Maybe we'll get into some of those, but I know you have a few documentaries that you'd like to share that we'll probably link into this too. But it's just, I don't know. It seems like any perspective you come from it, you could take something out of it.
It's absolutely true. And, you know, what... So consciousness studies is a huge emerging field right now. And there's a growing consensus, you know, for people like Rupert Sheldrake that are coming to believe in what is called panpsychism. It's the idea, as Ross says, that everything is conscious, everything is aware, just different levels or gradations of awareness, of expression of consciousness. Okay. So there's quite a lot of evidence, and you know, it's an exciting time now because we're finally emerging from the last 500 years of Cartesian, you know, René Descartes, you know, beliefs that the universe is a machine, that they kind of wrote God out of the equation because of this division between church and state and science.
Yeah.
And like anything, you know, as humans, we tend to be hardwired to galvanize into two camps and fight over everything. And the reason is usually somewhere in the middle, and we lose that reason. So, you know, I laugh because I think, you know, it's these false dichotomy of choices that we are given is how we are largely controlled. You know, the idea of it's either evolution or it's intelligent design. Well, the truth is somewhere in the middle. Right. You don't have to deny the truth of evolution, which is, you know, I mean, it's a fact. You look at dogs and how all the different varieties of dogs that we have from essentially the same DNA as wolves. You look at like the fossil record for horses, the fossil, you know, growing from a dog-sized animal through breeding to a warhorse. You look at giraffes. I mean, whether it's the fossil record, whether it's breeding programs, just in the short time that humans have been around and keeping dogs, whether it's epidemiology, of course, evolution is a real principle, but that doesn't mean there isn't a divine power guiding that force, you know. And as Ross says, you know, there is nothing random about evolution. There's a plan, there's a design there. So anyway, I digress a little bit, but yeah. So anyway, that's kind of, you know, it's an exciting time to be alive. NDEs have been around really as long as people have been around, and there are accounts of what sound very much like NDEs going back to ancient Greek times. As far as the history, they really didn't emerge into the kind of the realm of public discourse until the mid-70s. There was a very famous book called Life After Life, written by Raymond Moody. And, you know, that caused many, many people to come forward to share their experiences. It was a little bit like the ET phenomenon when Communion came out by Whitley Strieber. People saw that book and that face of the alien, and it caused them to remember what might have been a repressed, you know, memory and come forward. So anyway, since 1975, there have been, you know, many, many, many people coming forward, sharing their NDEs. You know, some have written books on them. Some have given interviews, and they're all really fascinating. So no two are identical, and they're much like the ET phenomenon. There's a certain amount of tailoring of an experience to the subjective beliefs of the individual in a way that will allow their psyche to process what they're experiencing without damaging it. So there's a little bit of that, but you hear the same themes coming up over and over and over again. And it basically could not be more consistent with exactly how Ra describes the nature of our universe. Unity, love, light. And so anyway, that's why I found them very meaningful. And they're just inspiring when you hear people talking about most of the people that have them have been through a life-threatening either disease, an auto accident, you know, some horribly traumatic thing. But after this NDE, you know, it's usually the most incredible experience of their lives. They come back with no fear of death, really in a profoundly changed way. They tend to gravitate away from religion and more towards spirituality. They realize that the truth is much bigger than any religion can contain. They all have bits of truth in them, but they also are limiting. They're essentially limiting beliefs. So it's kind of interesting. And unlike a dream, people remember them vividly for the rest of their lives. And they come back saying that it was more real than this everyday reality. It makes this feel like the dream.
Yeah, I want to get into that a little bit more, too, I think, with some of the Ra quotes. But maybe now would be a good time. Let's kind of, can you walk us through the timeline, I guess, of the NDE? There's common steps, I guess, like you're saying, with some of those, and then we can kind of get into some Ra quotes or something.
Sure, yeah, I'd love to talk about that. So the first, you know, the first step that happens in an NDE is basically dying. And, I, you know, personally, I think near-death experience is a misnomer because these are really people that were dead and came back. The only reason that it's called a near-death experience is because they came back, but they clearly crossed over into a tremendously expanded awareness and consciousness of what's going on. They just happened to come back. In some cases, they were brain dead. There was no neurological activity going on.
In their physical body.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay. But yet they had these, a richer experience than anything they've had here, which is really fascinating. But it's consistent with, you know, the veil of forgetting being lifted, you know, the doors of perception, as William Blake said, being cleansed. And all of a sudden, you know, so the first thing that happens is someone will realize, and they could be, you know, in a coma from cancer, they could be in an auto accident, but all of a sudden they often find themselves looking down at their body. And this is probably the most challenging step because they don't recognize themselves. They don't, you know, there's a famous one, Howard Storm, that was convinced, like, somehow they had replaced him with a mannequin. And why would they get this mannequin? You know, people don't, they don't recognize how frail and fragile and broken their physical body is. So they're kind of looking down from a place above that. They'll notice, even though their body is unconscious, they're in a coma, they'll notice things going on in like the operating room. They'll notice things on a high shelf in the room, you know, from a vantage point that they wouldn't even be able to see if they were conscious. They have what they describe as like a 360-degree vision. They see everything going on. They can move through walls. They experience and hear conversations taking place down the hall. Mm-hmm. They see their loved ones on the other side of the room. I'm sorry, the other side of the world, getting on a plane to kind of come meet them. So it gets into that non-locality of consciousness, mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting. Before I forget, I mentioned panpsychism. The other thing I wanted to mention is what's some of the conclusions of consciousness studies are all pointing to this concept that consciousness is fundamental among all our sciences. So the physical sciences have typically or historically been ranked in a hierarchy. You have physics, you have chemistry, you have biology, all building one upon the other. Mm-hmm. And then consciousness, which was often been referred to as the hard problem, you know, was seen as a just strange epiphenomenon resulting from wet brain tissue, electrical circuits, somehow generating self-awareness. What's happening is that whole paradigm is shifting to this belief that consciousness is more fundamental, exists before, in a more fundamental way, all of those other sciences, that they emerge out of this divine unified consciousness that is both the creator and each of us as part of the creator. So
right, and it's not just a factor of the brain, where, you know, it seems so hard to tear consciousness away from the brain in our scientific community now, but they're, like you're saying, it's starting to come around a little bit to consciousness being fundamental and part of everything and anything we can see here. So it's beautiful.
And it's an exciting time to be alive, because these NDEs were kind of emerging around the same time as the Law of One was being channeled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an exciting time now because there's all these kind of information sources, information streams all converging a little bit.
Yeah.
So that we're able to get a clearer picture of what's going on in a way that, you know, we didn't have this data readily available before our lifetimes in many ways.
Right.
So as I mentioned, the first step is realizing you're dead, that you're out of your body. And then what people usually experience is getting kind of sucked up into a tunnel of light or traveling through vast reaches of space or sometimes over land. There's an experience of traveling great distances. And then they come to a place that one thing you hear a lot is almost like a valley, a transitional valley or a meadow, a beautiful, like verdant meadow or valley.
Like that Garden is like of Eden kind of thing?
A little bit like that, yeah. Or, I know the Vikings had a concept of that too in the afterlife.
Valhalla?
It might have been Valhalla. It's like a way station, and that you are ultimately, they're often met by either someone that is there to help them get where they need to be. So it could be a deceased relative. It could be a light being that some people interpret as an angel. The interesting thing is, like, it really boils down to semantics, you know. The difference between a being of light and an angel is really one of semantics in my opinion. So it's a matter of them having someone that meets them to take them where they need to go, which I interpret as, you know, lower to mid astral up into the mid astral realm. Which is a place that they can kind of heal.
Okay.
Yeah. And then they ultimately go through a life review. That is something that Ra talks about as well. So, with NDEs, they're often a kind of a condensed or abridged life review.
So they do go through a life review though, in these NDEs where they come back then.
Many do. Okay. I wouldn't say everyone does. But I think it depends on where you're at in your seeking and what you're kind of ready for.
Mm-hmm.
But they describe these life reviews as, you know, it's remarkably similar to what Ross says. It's like a book that you can kind of leaf through the pages at your leisure.
That you see all at once, right? Like, yes. It's like the grand view of it, but yeah, yes. Flipping around. And
some people describe it as like a big movie theater, and you have like rewind and pause. And the thing that is universally described is that they experience all the events of their life from the perspective of everybody else involved. So they often say it's the perspective of themselves at the time, their perspective of their expanded awareness in time space, you know, with the help of like a higher self or a guide, and also from the awareness of everybody else that was experiencing that event. And one of the interesting things is there's no judgment by an external source. There's no damnation. The only criteria that they are essentially evaluating themselves on was the quality of the love that they shared.
Wow.
And, you know, where they could have done better, where they did well. There are people that were incredibly successful that when they came to this point, thought they'd be getting pats on the back for all these job achievements. And none of that meant anything except, like, for Howard Storm, the moment he consoled his sister when she was really upset and he kind of showed her love, that was like the crowning achievement of his life that he came away with. So it's not in a judgmental way. It's more like, hey, it's like watching the game tape after the game. Where mm-hmm. could we have done a little better?
Yeah.
You know,
so, that's beautiful then to have that guidance there too. Cause a lot of times I'm sure it can be hard to see, oh, this is how I treated people. This is how I reacted in these kind of situations, and seeing that, but being in that non-judgmental context really is meant for learning the life review, as Ross says.
It is. And, you know, hey, I'll be the first to admit there's some portions of my life that I'm not looking forward to looking through again, where I know I could have done better, but I just remind myself if we could have done better, we would have. And, we have to have compassion for ourselves as well as everybody else involved. And so there's this life review. Some people are even given the ability to have like a multi-life review where they've described seeing dozens of prior lifetimes all playing out at once. Very rare, but it happens on occasion. That's kind of interesting.
I wonder if it's that book, that giant book that they get, and they kind of keep going back through this lifetime to see
the chapter that they're in now.
Yeah,
I think that's true.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Pretty cool stuff. So yeah, and then after that, you know, there's usually a period of healing, and a lot of this is through love. You know, people describe, you know, a force of love, you know, either a being of light. Some people describe like a galaxy of light with tiny little lights or souls coming in and out of it. But the love emanating from this light is 1,000 times stronger than anything they've experienced. It penetrates every cell of their being, like being standing next to a furnace. Wow. And they feel it just like entering them, healing all those, you know, those little pockets of pain or what have you going on. And they come back, you know, feeling really rejuvenated. There's also remarkable stories of physical healing where people that had terminal cancer are told that if they go back, they will be healed. And within days or weeks, it's totally gone. So it's pretty cool. But then, so the last thing that is common to all these is the going back in the body, which is if the NDE was the greatest experience of their life, the going back is sometimes described as the worst experience of their life. It's like being crammed into a hot closet, I've heard people say, or shoving your shoe into like a shoe that's like three sizes too small.
So it's like jamming your consciousness back into this meat suit that you're wearing here.
Exactly. And, you know, there was one woman that had like an overdose in a bar, and she ends up going back into her body while the EMTs are trying to get her to like acknowledge them and, you know, like asking her name and this and that. And it's a little bit funny because as she's kind of slowly recognizing that there's this person in front of her, in her mind, she's saying, "Oh, he thinks he's a he and I'm a me. And he wants me to move that couch that I have in the garage to burp up sounds to communicate with him," you know? So, you know, a lot of people experience this profound sense of unity. Like they realize we're all part of one thing, you know, it's all one thing, this tapestry of unified vibration. But so anyway, some of the people, when they come back, it's traumatic. And some people come back that have to wrestle with depression because they felt like this was the most, you know, the feeling of being on the other side is often the word that comes up all the time is home. I was home. I felt like it was home. And that having to go back, you know, is traumatic. And having to come back here, it's often said that you're given a choice. But, you know, my wife and I joke about it because rarely are people given a real choice. I think ideally they want you to buy into the idea that it's important to go back, that your time isn't over yet. But one thing that you hear a lot is like, "Oh no, you already agreed to go back." And people will be like, "Oh, when did I do that?" And they'll be shown some pre-incarnative scene where, yes, in fact, they had already agreed to have this experience and then go back and use it to help teach others. But anyway, it's kind of funny. So that's the other thing. And then when they come back, universally, as I mentioned, they lose any fear of death. They realize that it's actually an incredibly joyful, wondrous homecoming, a reunion, as Carlo Rueckert would say, entering into larger life, that gives them a tremendous sense of peace. And many people look forward to going back there.
Once you have that experience, I mean, I can only imagine, it's like we can only experience, I feel like, a fraction of that love that's really out there and is part of that. I mean, the other thing I'd point out too is this, if we haven't directly said it, they're traveling to the time-space realm at that point there. So things obviously operate a little bit different there, where you can travel through time, you can see all sorts of events in this grand overview like we're talking about, as Ra says, versus being here in this 3D illusion where you're moving through space with the time clock moving behind you. It's a totally different. So that's why you can do this whole life review, have these guides help you, and then come back. But this could be a matter of a fraction of a second before they're back in their body, right?
You're absolutely right. And people uniformly explain it just like that. They say that time moves totally differently. It's nonlinear. It's kind of stacked upon itself, overlapping without any like a linear vector kind of uniting all those things. Some people that are, you know, like in a coma for a couple days come back saying that they experienced months and years on the other side.
Wow.
That it was, you know, and that, as I mentioned, it was more real than this. It makes this waking reality seem like the dream. And they remember their experiences without revision for the rest of their lives. Unlike a dream that fades quickly and might change over time, this was something that stands out to them as realer than real, which I think makes sense. You know, you're experiencing a greater capacity for awareness, for consciousness. You don't have the filter of the brain.
Yeah.
You know, the regulator of the brain.
At least the left brain there.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot more focused than, yeah, in our day.
And, you know, it sounds like so wonderful. And, you know, Becky and my wife and I can't help it. We joke a little bit like, oh, these lucky people almost dying, you know, because clearly, you know, we'd all love to get a glimpse of, you know, being home and, you know, it would, you know, it would be a wonderful experience. But I remind myself that we are here to build faith and will. And so that, you know, part of how we do that is not knowing. And so while it's a tremendous gift that these experiencers get, it also robs them a little bit of their ability to put one foot in front of the other and build their faith that, yes, this is the nature of reality, even though you haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, and as they say, this that faith that we build now carries forward for many future dimensions in a way that is much more impactful than if we were just given all the information at once.
Right. Yeah, it almost seems like it's, at least some of those NDEs that I was reading too, it can be like a wake-up call to some people as well. Like, you come here, we sign these pre-incarnative, you know, contracts, for lack of a better word, to have this experience. But when you get so caught up in society, you get so caught up in just the way things are here, you're not necessarily achieving what you want. So going through the NDE, you realize, oh my gosh, there's so much more to all this. Let me change my outlook. Let me change my way I'm doing things. Maybe it's money. Maybe it's whatever. Isn't so important anymore. Let me open my eyes to another way of, you know, of doing life here to truly be of service more. And it's, I don't know, those are the ones that really, I thought were really beautiful.
I agree. You know, many people like get rid of their old career and go into like service professions, helping professions, spiritual teachers, guides. They'll try to write a book or lecture to share this with as many people as they can, which, you know, they realize that this is part of their service, you know, to come yeah. back and share this experience, to help give others faith, to help give them a sense of what this is all leading towards. So it's pretty remarkable.
It is. It is. Awesome. Well, let's look at a little bit of what Ra has to say here, since I love these quotes so much. So I wanted to look a little bit at 71.6. And this question here, Don's asking, as an entity goes through the death process in third density and finds itself in time-space, it finds itself in a different set of circumstances. Would you please describe the properties and circumstances of time-space? And so I'm going to paraphrase. This is kind of a longer quote here, so go on a few of them here. But what Ra says then is, the time-space or metaphysical experience is that which is a very finely tuned and although an analog of space-time, lacking in its tangible characteristics. In these metaphysical planes, there's a great deal of what you call time, which is used to review and re-review the biases and learned teachings of a prior, as you would call it, space-time incarnation. So the other part there, too, that was just interesting is that Ra also explains that there are certain helpers usually there as well to guide you along this process. So you're given this review and so many more entities that you've known, your friends, your family, everyone's kind of guiding you through this process. Since like you were alluding to, it can be kind of traumatic and there's quite a bit going on. So I don't know. I thought that was kind of really interesting. And the other key part I'll mention here, too, is that Ra says we go into our indigo ray body once we pass through this time-space realm into death at that point. So this body then is so much more energetic and light and so much more free. So you can view these experiences from that, from the way you need to actually learn from it. So do you think a lot of that ties in with what you've been describing?
Very much. You have like the grand overview, and people have described like during their life review, seeing it from this higher place. You know, whether it's with the, whether it's they're kind of assuming the higher self persona a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. extreme compassion and a helping vibration. But yeah, you hear that quite a lot. Some people, in terms of helpers, say like, there was a being there with me, and I knew them very well, but I couldn't look at them, but I knew that this being knew me and I knew it. You know, it's almost like, you know, like there are beings behind the scenes that, you know, helping us orchestrate this play of our lives a little bit. And we know they're there to help us, but we don't look at them. We don't break the fourth wall. And so anyway, I think that's kind of interesting. The other thing that I thought was really fascinating, and I don't know if you were going to go on to read this, is Ra describes time-space as existing at supraluminal velocities approaching the speed of light. So they're faster than light. This takes place faster than light approaching the speed of light, which I think is really interesting. And one of the things that I've heard from several different NDE experiencers is they experience or see colors that we don't have here. Mm. And some of them, they might be artists or might become artists. They'll come back, try to recreate this color that they remember vividly from their NDE, but they don't have anything here to recreate that. And I think this is another like data point that kind of bolsters Ra's explanation of where this occurs, because if you think about, you know, if you think about the world we live in now, where the speed of light is seen as an upper limit or a constant, if there's something faster than light that's either compounded light or sped up light, of course you're going to have colors that exist in that realm that wouldn't exist below the speed of light, where it's almost slowed down into slower wavelengths than what we have now. So I think it's kind of fascinating that instead of being an upper limit, the speed of light appears to be really more like a membrane or a meniscus separating the dense world of matter from the less dense in the sense of matter, but more dense in the sense of energy and consciousness realms of time-space, which is really thoughts, intentions, non-material energies of beingness that don't have a coarse physical component of matter attached to them. So anyway, I think that's kind of interesting that people talk about seeing different colors, and that to me makes perfect sense if they're experiencing something that is faster than light.
Yeah, no, that's a great point to bring in. I think, and again, this was in 71.6 there too. I'd recommend reading back to that one. But I think that also kind of ties in with the idea of going into your indigo ray body, a much more dense, higher level body at that point where you can interpret these colors. You can interpret life from a totally different perspective than, you know, being in the lower, slower vibration of their density here. So it's like a whole nother vibrant, vivid experience that can only really be experienced through that type of body.
I get goosebumps thinking about it. It's exciting. Looking forward to trying it someday.
Yeah, right. Well, I'll go there. We're not encouraging anyone to try to have an NDE, but it's but it's interesting to learn from at least their experiences. Let's see. I think we already had talked about then that I really like that quote we kind of mentioned there with the whole book of records of being in time space, looking through the time review. So kind of already touched on that. That was in 83.7. Another part that I'm very interested in too is this idea of pre-incarnational choices. We make these with our higher selves, karma, all this kind of constantly coming back and going through loops of these incarnational cycles, basically, and learning and coming back with our biases and then attempting to maybe correct that or see more of the love in the situations here overall. So do you see that quite a bit in the NDEs as well? Is this a common theme?
It is. You know, it's very clear that, you know, when people go through this, this isn't like one life and then the afterlife. This is a cycle of that we go through. You know, we have a period of incarnation where we bring in certain lessons that we want to work with. We choose certain qualities or traits that we want to accentuate to learn those lessons. And we even kind of pick the cast of our play in some ways. You know, some of the NDEs talk about really what some folks have called a a soul family, mm-hmm. where we have groups of beings that we're all kind of moving together, and we spend a lot of time. So what they also say is, like, you spend time after you do your life review, and then you have a period of healing, and you kind of distill the key biases and experiences. Then you go into a place where you're planning your next one.
Oh, okay. And that's like what Ross is.
Yeah. And so you have like a soul family, and we all agree to play different roles for each other to help learn the key lessons. They're usually about self-love, how to give more love, self-acceptance, similar themes. But there's one famous NDE by a man named Eben Alexander that I'll mention in a little bit. But he mentions how while he was having his NDE, he saw that even his greatest nemesis, this person professionally that had blocked him and he had seen as like an arch enemy, had agreed to play that role to help him learn. So it's like we're like a theater troupe, and we each person's life is like a new production. And, you know, someone, you know, volunteers to play the heel. Someone volunteers to play, you know, the spouse. Someone volunteers to play the child. And we all swap roles over time so that we can kind of experience it from all different perspectives. You know, there are some people that, you know, they realize that, you know, there's a really interesting one, Jeffrey Olson, who is a fascinating NDE. He fell asleep at the wheel and killed his wife and his infant child.
Oh my gosh.
It was just this, and he had severe physical injuries, you know, almost lost his legs. And anyway, he went through this horrible period of like guilt. But while he was in this NDE, and he would have later experience as well, he got to hold his infant son that he had killed and kind of see that it was fine, to kiss it, you know, to send it love. And there were periods where he would be in touch with his dead wife, his deceased wife. And at one point he was saying how he was at her grave and he was angry. How could she leave him like this? Why would she do this to him? And he received communications from her. Because when people come back, there's often a thinner veil, and they may have continuing, you know, interaction with their guides, with their spirits, with their deceased loved ones. They may have psychic abilities.
Right. It's like you've seen the other side.
Yes.
And now you can kind of access it a little bit easier.
He was still there a little bit. Pathways, you've created these pathways. But so his wife was like, please don't say that. I did this for you so you could learn, you know, and it was clear that they had planned this event pre-incarnatively, that this would happen so that he could learn, you know, how to deal with loss, how to deal with love. And she eventually helped him find another partner and start over again and have a new family with. But anyway, it's very clear when you listen to these that we all play different parts for each other to help us learn. And once you come to appreciate that deeply, it's very hard to blame anybody for anything, because you realize, you know, maybe you had an abusive parent. You realize that wasn't done to you, that was done for you, that this person probably agreed with you to play that heel in your play to help you learn forgiveness and love, which is, you know, it's a pretty mind-boggling experience.
Yeah.
A realization, I should say.
Right. Those are probably some of the hardest lessons to be able to grasp or even wrap your head around, because it kind of sounds terrible in this sense. Okay, I've agreed to basically be abused or something in this lifetime, but there's something more underneath that is really the lesson, and that's usually the hardest part to distill, but is also your greatest opportunity in one sense too.
Well said. And as my wife and I joke, it's all light on light violence. You know what I mean? We're all just here to learn. We are truly limitless, infinite beings of light. It's all the creator learning through us and becoming more than it was through our more granular experiences, you know, for want of a better word. So no one is really harmed, as traumatic as it feels at the time. Mm-hmm. And it's all being done to help us learn love and forgiveness, both of self and others, I think.
Yeah, along those lines, I think I like the story that Jim McCarty with LL Research kind of tells a lot too, where he's kind of started to learn some of his pre-incarnational choices that he made, and one of them was to overcome anger. So he'd have a lot of anger issues. He would break things. He tells the story better. But eventually, one of the nights he was laying in bed, I think this was in his, I forgot if he said 50s or 60s, so still going through all this, just said, what if I can accept this part of me? What if I can accept this anger and have this pretty amazing experience? It sounds like almost like an awakening or an actual acceptance of that anger, learning the lesson, the pre-incarnational choice you had there. And it just, it changed him from there. So I don't know. I think there's also signposts that you can also realize when you've possibly stumbled onto something that is part of your pre-incarnational choice or lesson you hope to learn here as well, too.
I think you're right. And, you know, Kuo talks a lot about integrating the shadow self. Mm. You know, you heal it by loving it and accepting it. And, you know, as Ross says, we are everything, every thought, all things. You know, as Kuo says, we are the murderer. We are, you know, the abuser. We are everything. We are one unified being experiencing kind of individuated quantum of consciousness. But yeah, we are in truth everything. And, you know, how we heal, just like Jim said, is by learning to embrace those lesser desirable qualities within us, recognizing that we, you know, the balancing exercise, as Ross says, where, mm-hmm. you know, patience, impatience, you know, we recognize that, you know, both the desirable and the undesirable qualities are just a spectrum of our totality. Yep. And that we eventually, once we integrate and accept that, we recognize that we have two different ways to experience on behalf of the Creator.
You're presented with that opportunity, basically, to choose how you want to interpret that, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the idea of karma, of biases, is also very present. You know, people recognize they may get glimpses of past lives where they had done something that they realized something in this life was designed to try to balance that out. Mm-hmm. But it's very clear that we are timeless, limitless beings of light, going through these cycles of incarnation and then, you know, time, space, for the purposes of learning and expanding, ultimately our consciousness and our awareness.
Working through the densities in that sense, but trying to learn the lessons of those particular densities with the opportunity to do this review and pre-plan in the time, space, disincarnate state, right?
Very well said. Yes.
Yeah, the idea of karma is just kind of is fascinating to me as well, just how it can also, it obviously continues with you through lifetime and through lifetime. So something you've done, say, 2-3 lifetimes ago, you might be first working through now. So it's not like just this simple, what I did in this lifetime is what's coming back to me or anything like that. It can be so much more complex. And that's also where a lot of these pre-incarnative choices seems like they come from, is to try to burn through a little bit of that or work through it and come to that state of acceptance. So it's, there's so many layers to this, but that's what also makes it so fascinating and really much more of the vivid experience of the peacock tail, I think,
yes,
as Ross says.
Fully articulated, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, we're fleshing out all the little beautiful nooks and crannies of consciousness, of beingness.
Yeah.
Like this, like the fanned peacock tail. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful analogy. The other thing I wanted to mention is another principle that comes out of NDEs that ties into the raw material is the importance of free will. That
yes,
it's clear there is utter respect for free will, which is, you know, really, you know, the foundational principle for anyone polarizing in service to others. So there is a small percentage of NDEs that are, for want of a better word, hellish. You know, Ra mentions that wherever we're vibrating in time space, when we die or cross over, we go to an equivalent vibration. I'm sorry, wherever we are in space time, when we cross over, we go to an equivalent vibration in time space. So if we are, you know, if we resonate very negatively, if we, you know, people that are atheists or philosophical materialists that are, you know, angry, hateful, fearful people, they may cross over into an area of time space that's less than pleasant. And I'd say maybe 10% of the reported NDEs involve some type of experience that way. But it's interesting. Some I've heard where they just go into like an empty void and they feel like there's like a barrier, like this voiding barrier between them and, you know, what's going on back in the real world. And they come to realize that these are walls that they created based on their own belief system that they reinforced over time. And, you know, there's a very famous experience by a guy named Howard Storm who went on, you know, he went on Oprah, and I haven't heard a really good retelling of it, but you can find it in written form on neardeath.com, near-death.com. But he was a tenured art professor, self-admittedly a really bad person, competitive, materialistic, just kind of an unpleasant person to be around. And he crossed over and, you know, had really a very hellish experience where, you know, he was appeared to be lured into like a lower astral plane by, you know, beings that he couldn't quite see. But then he was, you know, essentially brutalized and left, as he said, kind of torn and broken. And out of nowhere, he heard this voice say, "Pray to God." And, you know, he didn't believe in God. He was really trying to like remember some type of prayer that he might have picked up. He started reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. But what happens is, in every one of these experiences that I've listened to or read, as soon as you reach out beyond yourself, as soon as you ask for help, as soon as you pray, it doesn't matter what the words are. It doesn't matter what how you formulate it, what you call God, any of that. As soon as you reach out and acknowledge a power beyond yourself, it's like you send out a signal from these lower astral realms, and you are basically honed in on by, some people have seen angels, some people see a light being that picks up on that signal and will immediately come and basically take you where you need to be. So it's like amazing. You hold the keys of your own liberation, you know? So anybody that's experiencing these negative realms, as soon as they reach out and they ask for help, they get it, which is, you know, like Ross said, or as it says in the Bible, ask and you will receive, knock and the door will be opened. And so it's pretty interesting. You know, I've heard some NDEs where people have said they were snatched up by a demon. And as soon as they started praying, like the Archangel Michael came with a flaming sword and grabbed them. And, you know, I don't know how much of this is a construct or is tailored to them, but the principle is, you know, if you find, you know, for, if you had to have like two basic instructions after you die, one is realize that you're dead and then ask for help. And yeah. It doesn't really matter what you say, just acknowledge that you need help and ask for it and you'll get it.
It's like that intention, basically, out the intention that, you're open to that and the light comes.
And the converse is, if you don't, if you just want to believe that you are all there is, that there's nothing beyond you, that, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog, you know, survival of the fittest world, and, you know, there's no higher power or force at work, that's your right to believe that. And you can experience, you know, all that entails, you know, with a bunch of other beings that believe similarly to you. But eventually you will get to the point where you realize you need help and you'll ask for it and you'll get it.
Well, and that's kind of like the coming together also of like the unity of all things as well, is admitting, maybe not admitting, but realizing more or less that all is one. So coming together, opening that up, not just being the one, okay, I control this situation. I can do X, Y, Z. I don't need to ask for help, but just kind of absorb and allow yourself to unify then with the creator and the creation.
Exactly. It's either separation or non-separation. And it doesn't even matter if it's a baby step into non-separation. As long as you acknowledge there's something beyond you, that it's, you're not just some solipsistic, self-contained, meaningless point in consciousness, then the whole universe kind of opens up to you a little bit.
Yeah.
Want of a better word.
I mean, it is kind of beautiful when you put it in that perspective as well, too. It's just so much to be learned from all these different experiences, too. And I think it kind of impacts everyone a little differently, but there's a lot of those common underlying themes in there that can be gleaned from it.
Yeah, totally.
But I think we're getting near our end here, so I think there's one last quote I was hoping to look at with you, and then we'll do some closing thoughts. But I was looking at 30.4 here, and this is where, so I'll read the question as well. Is there any loss to the mind or spirit after this transition, which we call death, or any impairment of either because of loss of this chemical body that we have? And Ross says, in your terms, there is a great loss of mind complex due to the fact that much of the activity of a mental nature of which you are aware during the experience of this space-time continuum is as much of a surface illusion as is the chemical body complex. In other terms, nothing whatever of importance is lost. The character, or shall we say, pure distillation of emotions and biases or distortions and wisdoms, if you will, becoming obvious for the first time, shall we say, these pure emotions and wisdoms and bias distortions being, for the most part, either ignored or underestimated during physical life experience. So, and last part here is, in terms of the spiritual, this channel is then much open due to the lack of necessity for the forgetting characteristic of third density. So I thought that one was kind of beautiful, and it really just ties it all together, too, with this idea of the near-death experiences. But what were your thoughts on that one?
I totally agree. And, you know, death isn't an end. It's a release into the larger life, as Carla Ruckert used to say. And I like that. I like that. It's a homecoming. We are welcomed home to a place where we feel love and belonging and unity that's beyond anything we can even describe in our waking lives. So I think it's how can you not look forward to that?
Right. It gives another perspective, I guess, on death there and learning all this from that point. But yeah, well said. Beautiful. I think that's a great point to end on here. So I think, I'd like to put a little bit of those books and videos and everything you'd mentioned also in the comments below. So people, if they're interested in exploring these a little more, we can look at it. But I guess I'll turn it over to you. Do you have any closing thoughts? I'm really grateful you're able to join us today. It's been a great conversation.
Well, thanks, Nathan. Yeah, I'm really, really happy we could have this talk. There's a couple significant NDEs that I think are worth listening to. One is a man named Eben Alexander. He was a neurosurgeon that taught at Harvard for many years, and he had a very rare and almost fatal case of meningoencephalitis that was caused by E. coli that essentially wiped clean his cerebral cortex. So all the portion of his brain where consciousness is supposedly taking place was ravaged and totally wiped by this bacteria. And while he had no brain function going on, he had this incredibly amazing NDE where, you know, he experienced a lot of those things that we're talking about. He was escorted by a woman, this beautiful woman that he didn't recognize, that only later did he find out was his birth sister that he never knew existed, that had passed away a few months before this experience. A very interesting story. And anyway, he came back and tried to assimilate. You know, he was very much a scientist, a materialist, reductionist materialist in his philosophical outlook, and really had to process all what this meant. And it's interesting because it's clearly not a phenomenon of the brain, because he had no brain activity when this was happening. If you can find his full discussion, it's really worth listening to. Another one is Anita Murjani. She has a very famous NDE account. She had terminal lymphoma and went into a coma where her body was ravaged by tumors that were the size of lemons.
Wow.
And while she was in this NDE, she met her deceased father, had this wonderful like healing process, and she realized through this experience that she believed she had given herself cancer through living in fear, through not letting herself truly be who she was meant to be. And while she was there, she was told, if you come back, your body will heal. And so she came back, and within 2 or 3 days, her tumors had shrunk by 70%. And within 3 weeks, there was no sign of them at all. Which,
unbelievable, you know, by our scientific standards.
It is here, truly miraculous. Mm-hmm. And she went on to talk and write and share her experience, but it's another one very uplifting, worth listening to. I mentioned Howard Storm. That his written account is available at neardeath.com. That's near-death.com. Another really good resource is a YouTube channel by a man named Anthony Chen, C-H-E-N-E.
Yeah.
He's a French filmmaker that has maybe a dozen, maybe 15 NDEs that of people he's interviewed that really tell their full story, which I think are all worth listening to. So he has a playlist on NDEs there. And then the last one I'll recommend to your listeners is there's a woman named Trisha Barker, who she is also an NDE experiencer. Her NDE experience is on Anthony Shen's YouTube channel, but she has her own YouTube channel that is now called Be the Light of Your Own Healing. And she interviews dozens of NDE experiencers that kind of share their story. And they talk about commonalities that she had with her story.
Oh, cool.
And it's more of kind of like a free form interview and dialogue rather than just a presentation. So I found every one of these really helpful and interesting, thought-provoking, and inspirational. So
yeah. Well, I think that's great, too, because it's like we were saying earlier that the Law of One can be very dense, so there's a lot to break down. But then when you can kind of relate it to other things or see the commonalities in some of these experiences, like these NDEs, it just, I don't know, it puts it in another context, and it's easier to understand sometimes that way. So yeah, I think there's definitely some value to it.
I think so as well. And you're hearing, you know, someone speak from personal experience, and instead of a grand overview, you're having like a, you know, a one person's experience of what it's like to cross over and then come back.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, how could you not be fascinated by that?
Oh, exactly. Well, thanks, Chris. It's meant a lot having you on here today. This has been a lot of fun, and I hope to have you back, because there's a lot more to dive into with the Law of One and NDEs and all of your other experiences as well.
Oh, the pleasure's been mine. It's been great chatting today, and I'd love to do it again sometime.
Of course. Well, we'll have you back soon. I'd like to thank the listeners for joining us today, and we hope to see you next time. Thanks.